This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I want to just first express before I really start diving in here how surreal this all is, and I want to say something to any young folks in the room as somebody who not that long ago was a young volunteer at this conference, and then over the years maybe a panelist or two. Keep working. And know the power of your experiences and the value of your experiences. Doing this research has really been a passion project. It wasn't research that I needed to do. If anything, I spent a lot of nights working on this research when I really didn't need to be doing it. But I felt compelled to spend what time I had at Duke, you know, with access to professors and the time that I had on the East Coast doing this, because the history of autism has been so often shaped by research, especially research that has ended up harming communities, whether it was Leo Kanner or Bruno Bettelheim or Jonathan Wakefield. Research matters. And one thing that I felt very passionate and determined to do, and why this feels so special today, is in this space, in this Miracle Coast center of research innovation, it means a lot to me to be talking about research that is inspired by the struggles and sacrifices in this room. So often when you see research at conferences, it's about cells. And yes, it is about autism, but autism ends up being so downstream. And I wanted to produce research that really was about your day-to-day experience, the day-to-day experience that I've seen as a volunteer and as somebody who worked at Autism Tree at various points, the financial sacrifices that you've made, the day-to-day experience where you're trying to do the best you can and you run up against obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. And so my goal with this research when I was putting it all together was to try and capture at least some of that experience in a way that legal academia could understand. Because so often, you know, our research institutions, our institutions of higher learning, can really only hear a message if it's done in a very specific way. And so this is, in a sense, my effort to put the experiences that I've saw over the years, getting to know you all, getting to help you in your struggles in a way that my law professors could understand and read and comprehend. And so to anybody doing research moving forward, trust that your experience is valuable, because it is so valuable. And it is something that people not just should hear, but need to hear if we are going to get to a place where autistic people and their families can operate better in society. So now let me dive into this a little bit. So what we're going to be talking about today is the tax code, and specifically how the tax code treats what I call but-for costs. And so the gist of but-for costs, and I take this from a case that I'm going to talk about in a little bit, is the idea that this is a cost that you wouldn't have if your child didn't have a disability, but for disability. And so I spend a lot of the first part of my paper talking about all these different costs, and they really kind of boil down broadly into two types of costs. We have upfront costs, and what I mean by this are costs that you incur at or near the point of diagnosis. All of those bills on therapy. So the example I kind of use as a basic one is music therapy, right? You know, you get told you need to have all these therapies for your child, and that's what you need to help them be able to be ready for kindergarten and be ready for school and be ready for all these things. So those are upfront costs. Then we also have long-term costs. You know, unfortunately, the employment market already is very tight right now. The employment market has always been tight for autistic people. The number that I cite in my paper is a roughly 85% unemployment rate for adults with autism. And this study is a little bit old, but I don't think it's that old. The average wage that a person with autism has worked for before the age of 25 is $8.08. Not exactly a living wage. And so we also see a lot of long-term costs, because you also have to be thinking about when you have a child with autism, not just the near-term therapy costs, but the costs of, okay, I might need to be subsidizing this child, this individual, for their lives. And you also need to prepare for those. So the kind of emblematic long-term costs I talk about are group homes and, you know, monitored care. And then I think kind of another cost that I do just want to shout out are the costs that it takes on families. Because, right, if you need to be consistently making money to pay for all these upfront costs and save for all these long-term costs, it restricts your ability to take opportunities and be where you want to be. Dr. Sabat was talking about how in California we see more because there's greater access to services. Moving to services is an example of a family cost. So how do all these costs break down in the code right now? And the answer is it's a complicated question. Now, you would think most obviously the spot where you might be able to get some relief for all these costs you're having to take on is the medical expense deduction, so Section 213. So I put the big quote up there, and the point that I really want to emphasize about this deduction is that the reason why the medical expense deduction exists is because Congress, sometime back in the 40s, believed that spending on medical expenses past a certain point creates a hardship that should be reflected when calculating your taxable income. And so ever since roughly the 1960s, they decided that, you know, if it is past 7.5% of your adjusted income, then that should be deductible. That is not something that you should be taxed on if you were spending money on a medical expense. But the problem really is, what is a medical expense? And so you realize that this ends up being pretty limited. First, again, we have that adjusted gross income barrier. You only get to start deducting if you've spent, let's say, $100,000. If you have a $100,000 income, $7,501. So you already are having to take the hit on 7.5%. But where a lot of this paper really starts to dig in is what it means to be incurred primarily for alleviation of a specific or mental defect. You can't just deduct for general health under the medical expense deduction. Now, personally, and I'll get into this more, I have a substantial problem with this, but a couple examples on things that the courts have not found. You can't deduct vacations, even if the environment is healthy, and you can't deduct schooling in a specific atmosphere believed to be conducive to treatment. And this basic standard is roughly alleviated in the case where I pulled but-for from, which is Jacobs v. Commissioner. And they have this fun test that if you're a taxpayer and you want to deduct, you need to prove. One, the existence of the disability. And then two, that the payment is proximately related. And in essence, what that means is that it wouldn't have happened but for medical reasons. And how you really prove that is you introduce evidence. It's on you as the taxpayer, if you get challenged, to show all this evidence that, you know, the person administering the care has special training, that the provider holds themselves out as administering, you know, this type of care. And, you know, for the parents in the room, I think you can see where the problems start to come fast and furious, because you can't necessarily find qualified, you know, medical providers holding themselves out in a medical way for all the things that your child will benefit from. And so a particular issue that I find is this old doctrine. It dates back to 1960, and it's called the special school doctrine. And the only way to get a deduction for special education, and this is still true in 2025, is if the education is incidental to the medical care. And ultimately, this gets followed up in a 1981 case. It's a tax court case called Fay v. Commissioner. And you'll see I put this giant paragraph up there. And this is this paragraph, what it is it's all the things that the family did before putting their child in private school. They had access to a free parochial school. And a lot of these steps, probably to people in the room, look familiar. Right? They went to doctors. They tried to talk to the teachers. They even tried to lobby the school to create a program. And after all that, eventually they said, you know what? We'll just put them in the program that everybody's recommending. And so even after doing all that, did the court find it deductible? No. And the reason why they didn't was just because the school's raison d'etre was Montessori education, that the purpose of the school was not remedying, in this case, it was about dyslexia, remedying the dyslexia. The purpose was education. Now, they did find that fees related to special education is deductible. So it's not like they didn't give anything, but still, there's this much bigger but for cost beyond the actual special program, which is the entire school. And so we kind of get three big implications from this doctrine in Fay. One is that dual purpose expenditures are disfavored. So you can't say, oh, it's for a medical purpose, but it's also for a different purpose. And the IRS will buy that. That but for isn't deductible, but that your best shot at getting deductibility is essentially creating a separate fee. And the reason why I see such a problem with this is because, you know, we talked about 1960 being the doctrine. We didn't really have special education as viewed as a public thing until well into the 1970s. I mean, really, truly a disturbing history that two out of the three states providing educational programs for disabled students in 1975 were sued in a class action litigation for infringing upon that right to education. And because one of those class actions was decently successful, that is what pushed Congress into passing what was the precursor to IDEA called the EAHCA, was mainly because they knew they needed to do something because of this lawsuit. And so their solution was to pass the EAHCA, which would become IDEA. Now, the trick about IDEA, and it's important to really keep this in mind, is that that bill was passed with what's called a ratable reduction. And so Congress not just – they authorized trying to, you know, fully fund this need, but consistently Congress for the past over 50 years has chosen to not appropriate enough money to fully fund IDEA. And so when you think about the state of public special education, in my opinion, it ultimately comes back to this, that it's not a question of can we do it? It's a question of Congress has said that this is not enough of a priority to do it. And I'm not saying that, you know, it wouldn't cost a lot of money. It very much would. But I think it is a useful thing to keep in mind that theoretically, Congress could just appropriate enough money to fully fund public special education, but has chosen not to do so. And so what we do see more recently as another way to get tax relief is through basically what's a revision of a 529 plan. This is the result of disability rights advocacy. There was a bill passed in 2014 called the ABLE Act, 529A. And the underlying reason why this was passed is that the guy that's pictured up there is named Stephen Beck, and he had a daughter with Down syndrome. And he wanted to save money for his daughter's long-term care. And what he came to realize when he tried to do that was if he put more than $2,000 into an account in his daughter's name, that she would lose eligibility for her federal benefits. And so then he went and lobbied Congress, and that at least got somewhere, because his argument was if neurotypical parents can save for their child's college through 529, then parents with children with serious disabilities should be able to save through 529A. And so basically 529A is the same as a 529 plan. The main difference is that what you can spend the money on is what are called qualified disability expenses. And it's still a limited definition. It doesn't necessarily cover everything under the sun. But as you can see up there, it's much broader. It covers education. It covers housing. It covers wellness. It covers even financial management, which are categories that rarely are going to be covered in the context of 213 and the medical expense deduction. Also with 529A, there's some serious limitations. Because it's benchmarked to the gift tax, you can't put in more than $19,000 a year, except for some very limited exceptions. And most importantly, in the same way, like as other kind of tax beneficial accounts, the contributions are still taxed. So you're just paying the tax when you put the money in. The real benefit is that you hope that the money accrues interest over enough time, and then you can take the money out and not have to pay taxes on that accrued interest. And additionally, and we'll come back to this more, you have to certify the disability in order to actually be able to get one of these accounts. So I'm going to bring this chart back up for a minute, and I'm going to show you a little bit how this all kind of maps right now. Now, one thing that is really important to keep in mind that I admittedly held from you is that between the upfront and long-term costs, even though you're only spending on the upfront costs in maybe a 3 to 5 year period, and you're spending, you know, long-term costs over the course of a lifetime, 60% of the lifetime costs that you are going to be spending on are actually in the upfront category in that 3 to 5 year period. you know, those moments when you feel really financially pressed in the first few years after a diagnosis, that's actually because you're probably spending most of the money that you're going to spend on your autistic child over the course of their lifetime in those first few years. Now, looking down, what I've shown is there's relief under 213 and 529A. Now, at least with 529A, you can use an ABLE account to save for long-term costs and avoid paying taxes on the disbursement. That should theoretically help when you're doing that long-term planning. But at the moment, we still don't really have any way for a taxpayer to get meaningful relief under, you know, 213 or 529A for those upfront costs. You can get some done with medical expenses, right? If it's an unambiguous medical expense and you can show it's over 7.5%, you can get those. But how many expenses can you really prove fall into that medical category? And even then, you still have to have it exceed 7.5% of your income, and you only get what's on top of that. So I have a couple of tips to help out that are based on what we've been talking about to try and put it a little bit more practically. So one thing that you can do if you have a child in private special education is, and this assumes that there's no separate special education service fees, which might actually be a lot easier, but what you can do is you can identify the cost of the medical component and deduct. So these schools might look familiar to folks here in San Diego. On the left, we have the Newbridge School, which is a school about that serves students with dyslexia and helps substantially. It's the only dyslexia-focused school in San Diego. And on the right, we have the Maria Montessori School. You see similar student-teacher ratios. They're both in San Diego County. They serve students in the same years. Newbridge advertises as serving with dyslexia. Maria Montessori doesn't. And Newbridge costs more. And if you can make that comparison, and again, you have to be able to kind of show this on all these fronts, you can then claim that the excess, the difference between Newbridge and Maria Montessori in tuition, that's a medical expense. And the IRS will actually buy that. And because the reason why is that we've priced the education component for private education in the area as Maria Montessori. And so above that, that's the additional medical expense that's being caused. And so there's abilities to, you know, create that value for yourself, but you have to be smart with the comparison. And so actually, I went through a bunch of schools and did this. And so I think I found that in the case of Newbridge, there are 89 private schools serving third grade students in San Diego. Only 17 of them would work to make this comparison workable. I picked the one that would give you the biggest difference. So that is one thing to keep in mind. Again, ABLE will work well for long-term costs. If you're planning to, you know, if you're not planning to spend the money in an ABLE account for 20 years, it is smart to contribute in the same way that you'd contribute in a 401k or a Roth IRA. So that's the state of play currently. Now, what I did in the third part of this article is I talked about a couple of ideas that I think might help. And eventually I'll talk about the limitations, but I kind of did it on three levels. One that's real specific, and one that's a little bit broader, and then in the criticisms, one that's the broadest. So first, very specifically, obviously, I do not like the Fay case. I think the special school doctrine should be repealed. This up here is my in-text way of repealing it. And honestly, they probably should really go back and revise this language anyway, because if you look carefully at some of the language I crossed out, some of it isn't exactly appropriate for 2025. Probably wasn't appropriate in 2005 either, but here we are. And so at least this would be a very minor regulatory change. If, you know, the director of the IRS or Secretary Bessent wanted this change to happen, it could be done in 6 months. It would be in the code and we would at least have this. Now, again, this would still leave families stuck dealing with all the other obstacles in 213. But at least in terms of special education, this is a small thing that would make special education deductible, where under this doctrine that comes out of this language, it isn't. Now, looking a little bit broadly, I talked about ABLE, and I think that there's a way. All that would have to happen here is Congress would have to pass a bill. Admittedly, it's hard for Congress to pass a bill. We're seeing that right now. But what you would do, and I go in great detail on how exactly to do this in my note. But what I would do is I would detach Able from the gift tax and basically make it so that you could put contributions in tax-free and it would work as what's called a pass-through account. So you put the money in the account, and then when you spend the money, it's tax-free, and all that you're going to have to report as a deductible cost is the money you put into the account. Because, right, you're basically saying, you know, as I use for the gift tax, it's a qualified transfer. Money that you should be spending for qualified disability expenses, in my opinion, should be deductible. And so the pros of this approach is you're not dealing with the AGI barrier. You get deductibility for special education. And especially with everything going on with IDEA funding right now, it at least mitigates it a little bit and makes it somewhat practical to not be relying on public federal education spending, which has been historically insufficient and can be affected by political impacts. And what I like about this the most is that it places the point of recognized hardship at 1 cent. Because disability is a protected class. We don't necessarily always see disability get treated as a protected class in the law. And this is another example of where you see disability effectively get ignored. Because I think we all, especially the parents in the room, know that there's kind of an informal autism tax when you're going and buying things, that you aren't getting as much benefit out of the goods and services that a neurotypical child might receive for summer camp or daycare or just even school, maybe even public school. One thing that I had when I was younger, and I'm fortunate that my parents were able to pay for this, was having an aide in a public school classroom, privately funded aide, public school classroom. Yes, I was getting public education and services, but that wasn't enough. I needed more. And I think that's true for a lot of kids. In fact, one statistic that I pulled when I was thinking about this is that right now, 12% of all students receiving special education services under IDEA have an autism diagnosis. It is the single largest diagnosis for a student in special education, only comparable with entire categories of disability. So autism looks a lot more like the norm. The challenges that you are facing are not solely held by you. They are held by an even increasing significant percentage of the community. And so I want to talk about the limitations here too, because I think this really gets at the heart of what I wanted to ultimately kind of point out in this paper, is just how easily things get ignored. So of course, an ABLE account is great. You know, let's say Congress passes this, they do exactly what I write out in my paper. It even still probably wouldn't impact that many families. 88% of taxpayers took the standard deduction, right? Where you don't have to do any work. You just put in the standard deduction, that's it. 88% of taxpayers do that. If you would want to take advantage of an ABLE account and actually get the deductibility from an ABLE account, you would have to pass on the standard deduction and then, you know, go into itemized deductions and do all that complicated work. A second big piece of it is that ABLE programs require families to open and link a new bank account. One thing that we still see is that there's a substantial amount of Americans that are unbanked, that don't have access to financial institutions. We see this even more so in communities of color. And so if we really wanted, you know, the solution that I'm proposing with ABLE to be good for everybody, it would take additional work to solve to address unbanking in communities of color. And then the third piece of it, and this one I think I hinted at a little bit earlier, is that ABLE programs require families to get a disability diagnosis certification signed by a licensed healthcare provider. Autism Tree, kind of since day one, has known about the substantial delays and challenges with getting a diagnosis and getting medical professionals to recognize that autism, that a child has autism. And in effect, even if Congress did exactly what I wanted with ABLE, you'd still have to go back to the medical professional, get them to sign this document, go through that whole process to arrive at that endpoint. So that's everything that I kind of have prepared. I wanted to say one final thing. I'm a big fan of Otto Lana. Otto was great earlier, and I was reading his poem, Find Another Four-Letter Word, and there was a part that really stuck out to me. And I'm going to read it, and then I'll tell you what I think. I am interchangeable. In the next few minutes, there will be another nameless, faceless, autistic child in their office, in this chair, desperately trying to explain that nothing is fine. Nothing in their lives is fine at this moment. And it really resonated with me. And the reason why it did is because when I saw the word interchangeable, the thought that crossed my mind is that interchangeability is an institutional default. Our institutions, and this is something that I've seen at Autism Tree, it is something that undergirds kind of the philosophy of this paper, is that our institutions are not responsive. They're not responsive to specific families. And ultimately, even if you get the statutory change, it takes people fighting to break institutional inertia. And what I want to be clear is, even in those moments that you might feel interchangeable, it does not mean that you aren't competent. It does not mean that you aren't talented. It does not mean that you do not bring substantial value to society. It just means that our institutions are not able to address the challenges that we are facing on a daily basis and the challenges that we are seeing on a daily basis. And for all the people in this room, parents, kids, individuals, adults, the experiences that you are facing are valuable. And so with that, I'm going to take some questions. I'm going to go over to the chair right over here. I want to thank you for all your patience. I'll put my little thank you slide up.
What will it take to get these changes done? What can we do as parents and advocates to move that needle?
You know, I think that's a fascinating question, and it's a complicated one. And so I think I'll start kind of broadly and then work my way from there. I think on a broad perspective, it is being unafraid to talk about your experience. The most powerful thing that you have when you go into an official space is your story and your experiences. Because it's not, most in my experience, it's not that people don't want to get it. It's just that they don't get it. And so I think back a few years ago, I did a panel here at this neuroscience conference about an initiative that we got passed at the county relating to helping encourage employment of neurodiverse individuals. That initiative ended up passing 5-0 with support from both Republicans and Democrats. I think one of the biggest reasons why it passed 5-0 is because we had 800 people, different people, post comments encouraging the passage of that initiative on the text, on the website, in it. Ultimately, I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that while in some ways our elected officials are very unresponsive, in other ways they're actually quite responsive. And a lot of what we're seeing is elected officials doing what they think we want them to do. And so a lot of times, sometimes it's just a matter of actually standing up and saying, this is my experience, this is what you're doing, that is what you're doing here, what you think might be good, might not be as good as you think it is, and here's why. Because a lot of, I do still believe that people want to do good in this world, and people want to help. It's just a lot of times people don't surround themselves with expertise in the way that they should when they go about trying to help. So I think that's one thing, is being open. And I think that's especially true if you're in a position of influence. One thing I meant to kind of allude to earlier was when I was at Duke Law, I assumed that I was going to be the only autistic person there. Because you don't hear about autistic lawyers, really. Certainly not when I started law school, in 2021. I think maybe Extraordinary Attorney Woo had just come out, but that was in Korea. You still haven't really seen like an American version of that. And so I just thought I'd be the only autistic person there. And when I got to Duke, I realized, oh, wait a second, there are actually autistic people here. In fact, there was another autistic person in my section, and they were excellent. They did better than I did. But at the same time, did that person ever talk about their autism or publicly affiliate, put themselves out there as a behavioral other? No. And so I think a lot of, I think also a good piece of our problem, and it's one that, you know, I certainly am going to try to do my part to remedy, is that you don't actually see people talking about autistic people who have done everything that you hope, that have, you know, gone to law school. I work at a big law firm now. You don't see them talking about it, in part because a lot of these institutions make it difficult for you to be open about your background and experiences. But at the same time, your background and experiences are what actually bring you power. They are your expertise. And so when you kind of sit back and let other people, you know, continue being uninformed, it just lets everybody down in a way. Because there have been times where I've done that. And there's, you know, I end up feeling a little bit unsatisfied, but you kind of walk away and you do the best you can. But it doesn't make what's going on better. And I found in the times where I do kind of put it aside and I speak up and I talk about that, you know, it's definitely scary. Every so often there is a little bit of a cost. But ultimately people respect you for it. And ultimately the end product of whatever you're talking about, I think does end up being a little bit better. And so I think what I would say, just as a starting point, you know, getting to the idea of a political autism, I think is way down the line. But where I think it starts is people just being open about their experiences and talking about it and not being afraid when the time comes to talk about healthcare issues, to put autism in their back pocket and kind of sit on it. So I think that's one big piece. I think the other is, you know, using the media attention. I know there's been a lot more media attention on autism lately. And this is something that I tried to do. I wrote an op-ed in Newsweek. I don't know how much it did, but not being afraid to say when it does come into the spotlight, when you do have that opportunity to shape narratives, to come back and use your experience and try to do what you can to say, hey, this is what you should do to help. And eventually, if you do that enough times and you make it something that's useful enough for enough people, you can move the needle a little bit. Again, as I said above, I think it's a bigger cultural problem. It's not necessarily something that policy can solve, but I do think policy can help, but you can't really have that policy until the culture is in place first.
Can you give more details as to the, like, an organized way where we can share our stories? Like, you shared a site, or when there's a specific law that's being passed that we can share our comments to, but are there like lobby days that families can join where we can speak directly with legislators?
There are a few. I think one thing that I try to think about just broadly in political engagement is you don't do things that you believe in, do organizations that you trust, and work with people that you trust. I think that is one of the biggest ones. And if there's anything that I would have done maybe slightly differently in some of the things that I've done and as I've done my time in Washington and done some of these things, it's focusing more on who I really trust and work with. And so I think one thing that I will say is, because there's a lot of different political autism organizations that are trying to get political. And I think you have to figure out kind of what tone you're comfortable with. Now, believe me, I'd love to see everybody come together and kind of have that kumbaya moment and realize that our collective interests are bigger than maybe the specific interests, that there are unifying principles behind, I think, the struggles that families and both families with children with autism and adults with autism are facing. They're different, but there are some underlying similarities, and that's where I would love to see the focus. That isn't really the reality that we have, though. And so I think, you know, what I would encourage you to do is really think about, in terms of, you know, organizations, is do your research and really think about what message you want to send. I know that you're asking for more specific actionables, and I apologize that I'm not really giving them to you. But the reason why I'm doing that, I think, is just because I think our community is so big and so diverse. that I don't want to give you an organization, and then it turns out that that's a total mismatch. I will say one organization that I have appreciated a lot is the National Head Start Association. So if you do believe in preschool for federally funded preschool for low-income students, they're currently being affected by the government shutdown. And I know all my old colleagues at NHSA are pushing hard. If that is something that works well for you, that might be a decent starting point. I mean, obviously Autism Speaks is a big player, and Autism Self-Advocacy Network's a big player. But I think it's more a question of you kind of have to start with what change do you want to see specifically, and then work your way out. Because I know that change looks different for different people. And I don't want to accidentally send somebody down the wrong path just because, you know, I've worked with an organization and they've been great.
I noticed on your bio, you've worked at a couple different law firms. Mm-hmm. And when you self-disclosed your diagnosis, how was that received?
You know, it's really fascinating. I give a lot of credit to my current firm. Because I don't think it was taken. I think most firms got scared by it, honestly. When I worked at my first firm, which is on there, and I'm not going to say their name, but folks know who they are. The immediate response was, "Oh, you need to report that to HR," and I did. But I think part of when I was talking about cultural change, exactly what I had in mind. Is that when most firms, companies, period, hear autism, they get scared. They assume the worst. They assume you're Sheldon Cooper. And they don't stop assuming you're Sheldon Cooper. Yeah, he's brilliant, but... And agreed. He's brilliant, but they, you know, I don't mean the brilliance of Sheldon Cooper. I mean the Sheldon Cooper, the parts of Sheldon Cooper that drive people crazy. Sorry, that was not the most polite way to put that. But ultimately, I think a lot of firms hear autism and they get very scared. And admittedly, and I think I've said this when I was lobbying for the county initiative, is ultimately, you know, especially in this day and age with all the remote applying and interviewing, you don't really get the chance to help people see the bigger picture. Ultimately, a lot of times it ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy of a firm hears autism and they think that person's going to be disruptive and not a net value add. So then they don't hire them. And then the next time an autistic candidate comes along, they just do the same thing. And that's why I give a lot of credit to my current firm. Because when I, you know, even though, yes, I went to Duke Law School, I had decent grades. I externed for a federal district court judge, ended up writing this note later on. I think a lot of firms got spooked. And the firm that I'm at really didn't get spooked. They saw it as the plus that I see it as, that it's given me greater perspective, that I've had to learn how to advocate for myself, that I've learned how to lead in this community, that I get what it means to see families sacrificing. I think those things are pluses. Unfortunately, that's not something that a lot of people do see sometimes. And so I am not saying that there is not a real cost to putting yourself out there as an autistic professional. There absolutely is. But I think the real upside is that if you survive that and you say, like, yeah, I'm an autistic, you know, I am on the autism spectrum, but it's made me have to pay more attention to my communication, and it's made me have to learn how to advocate for myself and be more of a leader, and the company sees that, it ends up being a really great fit. And so I really enjoy working at the firm that I'm at, Rutan and Tucker. They even posted that I was going to be presenting at this conference, which, you know, that I didn't expect them to do that. I didn't really ask them to do that. And when you get the chance to be yourself, I think it works out great. But, you know, we've talked about employment at these conferences a lot. I've been on the panels. I've done these types of things. It's a slippery fish, and especially in a tight labor market, it's an even slipperier fish. And so, you know, I am very sympathetic about the challenges of being open about your autism diagnosis when you're trying to get a job. So to all the autistic folks listening, do what you gotta do. But if you have the luxury of being able to put yourself out there, please do. It's the only way that we're gonna change this cycle.
Thank you. What wonderful words to end with. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.